Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lelchuk. We hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Now, if you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much, much more. Remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. Here's Daniel Lelchuk.
On today's program, beloved and authoritative food writer Mark Bittman. He's the author of more than 15 books, including How to Cook Everything, Dinner for Everyone, How to Bake Everything, How to Eat, and very recently, a sort of different style of book, Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food, From Sustainable to Suicidal. As you'll hear in the conversation, I asked him, why not just keep writing cookbooks, keep teaching people how to cook and eat better? He said he wanted to do more. He's always been passionate about trying his best to make the world a bit of a better place for everyone and teaching us about food and where it comes from. What we can all do better, how we can eat better, is one of his goals. He says in the present, industrial agriculture has become a public health menace that exacerbates climate change and otherwise poisons the planet. I couldn't wait to hear him delve into this more. Here he is, Mark Bittman. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been writing cookbooks, recipes, essays, all about food for decades. People have come to rely on you for advice how to cook pancakes, pad thai, roast chicken, and steamed fish. But here you are with this most recent book titled Animal Vegetable Junk, A History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal. But why the need to take a turn towards the existential?
Well, I did, you know, write opinion columns about food for the Times for 4.5 years. So it's not, and longer than that, really. So it's not, but weekly for 4.5 years. And it's not a U-turn here. It's an addition. And it's a long story. I've been writing about food for 40 years, but the short version is there's more to food than cooking. And maybe I was slow to catch on to that, but I did catch on to that 15 or 20 years ago. And since then, I continue to do cookbooks. I continue to cook and love cooking and love talking about cooking. But I don't think we take food seriously enough. And I find evidence of that every day. We can talk about that if you want. But when I was writing opinion columns, I thought I'll create a mosaic. I'll do a column on some different aspect of food every week, and people who follow me after a while will understand better what the big picture looks like. But it didn't work. I mean, I don't know that a book is going to work either, but that didn't work. So I thought, okay, well, 100,000 words all at once, here we go. And 5 years later, here's Animal Vegetable.
So how do you know it didn't work? What do you mean exactly it didn't work? You're trying to send some message through the mosaic, through articles, 800, 1,000, 1,200 words, sometimes 3,000. Okay, so shorter, medium-length articles. What wasn't getting through? What told you that 100,000 words a book had to be the solution?
Well, I don't know that it's a solution, but it is a different approach, and it gave me the room to look at history and talk about how we got here and how decisions were made or not made, and where we are, looking at a big picture of where we are regarding food right now and what decisions should be made. I think it helped me understand the big picture better, and I know it's as good, you know, I think it's the best contemporary non-academic book about the big picture of food that there is right now. So I'm confident that people who read it will come to look at food in a different way and understand things much better than they do now.
Okay, let's just talk about one of the basic premises here. So you say up until a century ago, we had two types of food, plants and animals. But as agriculture and food processing became big industry, another type emerged, junk. What is junk food?
Well, junk food is slang for ultra-processed food, and ultra-processed food is food that doesn't exist in nature, food that sometimes doesn't even contain food that exists in nature, food that may or may not be made from food, or maybe it's better to say edible substances that may or may not be made from food. What happened 100, 125 years ago is that there was so much at that time. It was the big surplus was in wheat, but since then it's become corn and soybeans and some other things. But there's so much of certain crops that new uses had to be found for them. Now those crops are being grown for those new uses. But at the time it was, we have so much of this, what can we extract from it? How can we convert it to make things other than naturally occurring foods out of them that we can use in other ways? Some are to feed people and some are like ethanol to feed cars.
When did you start thinking to yourself that just sort of writing recipes that brought pleasure to kitchens like mine wouldn't be sufficient? I mean, isn't it nice to bring pleasure to people and sit back with a drink at the end of the day and say, that was a job well done?
You know, I think you're asking about who I am or how I think or feel. And I don't know the answer to that question. I just know that I wasn't satisfied. I do think that writing recipes, teaching people how to cook is respectable and a noble career. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It just didn't seem enough for me once I started to think about the bigger picture. It has to do with my background. I was a community organizer and a self-styled socialist and revolutionary when I was really young. And I think I've always thought that you want to do whatever you can to make the world a better place, to change the world into a better place. And teaching people how to cook is part of that, but teaching people where food comes from and what's wrong with it and how it could be better is a bigger part of that.
I grew up in rural New Hampshire near the Vermont border, near Dartmouth College. In the back, my mom had a huge vegetable garden, carrots, sugar snap peas, green beans, all kinds of lettuces out the wazoo. You know, local dairies over in Vermont. A lot of dairy seems to come from there and not New Hampshire. You know, chickens, etc. In short, sort of a food experience, a food education I experienced very different than most Americans. What did I gain from that at a young age?
I wonder. I mean, it certainly is. It's a decreasingly common experience. I often say that people in my parents' generation and my mother, who's alive, is 95, but people in that generation were sort of the first generation of Americans and maybe even people anywhere in the world where the majority of them did not know farmers. Things had become so urban that more and more people just had no idea of where their food came from or what it was about. And my mother to this day, I have chickens, but my mother to this day says, I don't like chickens because of some experience she had when she was 12 visiting a farm. And that was basically her only. So, I think one of the real problems with food is that children are not shown or taught where food comes from, what it means to grow food, how this all works. And I think, probably you have a better understanding of food for having seen that when you were young, but it is a rare experience now.
And my grandmother, who sounds about the age of your mother, would have the tuna noodle casserole with the Campbell's mushroom soup as the main ingredient. And, you know, I never got food like that up in New Hampshire from my mom, who was making, you know, real stuff. And it was like, what the hell is this? I mean, it was wonderful. I can't say it didn't taste good to my eight-year-old palate. You know, but the tactile experience of going into a garden when you're 4 years old and you know, rubbing the dirt off of a carrot, tasting it right then and there, you can't reproduce it. It's like the analog quality in a great musical performance. When you put it on an MP3 or a CD, it loses the depth.
Right. I'll leave that analogy to you, but I'm sure it's a good one. My ears are not as good as my palate.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the development of junk food. What were the, I don't want to say malicious, what were people doing? There was a rush to what at the beginning of all this?
You know, I like to not say malicious also, and I think that You can't really say what people's intentions were, but towards at the end of the 19th century, there was, I mean, and for 100 years before that, there was, population had begun to grow. I mean, global population grew mathematically, arithmetically, I guess it is, not exponentially. Is that right?
Not the right person to ask about those terms.
Okay. Let's say it grew slowly for thousands of years. So at the, you know, there were maybe 5 million humans at the end of the Ice Age, which was 10 or 12,000 years ago. And maybe 50 million was Christ, when Christ was born. So it wasn't that rapid. But after industrialization, after more modern agriculture, population grew, and as population grew, more food was needed. As more food was produced, population grew more. There was in the 19th and early 20th century, plumbing and sophisticated sewer systems and real medicine and so on, improved lifespans, and fewer and fewer people were dying from infectious diseases. The upshot was there was a sort of a level of hysteria about how we were going to feed, how people were going to feed themselves. And at the same time, there became a more sophisticated way, or I don't know if sophisticated is the right word, a new way to do agriculture. Increasingly, agriculture was monoculture. So instead of having a kind of farm that was basically your mother's garden writ large, which farms used to grow many different crops and they were sustainable and agriculture was what we now call regenerative and so on. Instead, farmers were growing one crop at a time and selling that crop for cash and figuring they would buy their food elsewhere. And this is kind of the philosophy of contemporary capitalism or neoliberalism, which is you produce what you're best at producing, and then you enter the cash market and you buy what you need from people who are better at producing the other stuff. When it came to food, it was tricky to do that, but with the invention of chemical fertilizer and the gasoline-powered tractor, it became much easier to plant and grow 1,000 acres at a time of just one crop. And that is not a natural thing to do. You don't see that in nature. You don't see one crop growing at a time anywhere in nature. When you go to a meadow or a forest or anything, nature is chaotic. There are thousands of things growing at the same time. When you go to a modern cornfield in Iowa, it's just corn, and everything else is the enemy, is seen as the enemy of corn. So everything is put into the soil and maintained so that only corn grows. You don't want to encourage bugs or other plants or anything, just corn. And what happens when you do that is, A, you have a lot of corn and you got to figure out what to do with it. Remember, we're trying to sell it on the world market so we have enough money so that we can buy the food we actually want to eat and other things also. But you also are robbing the soil of nutrients. You're replacing things in the soil with chemicals. You're poisoning the land and the air and the water around that by using those chemicals. And ultimately, you're creating food that doesn't really nourish people. So that's a process that began in the very late 19th and early 20th century and accelerated tremendously after the Second World War and even more in the 70s and 80s, to the point where the majority, I don't do a lot of statistics, but this is a big one. The majority of calories in the United States right now come from ultra-processed food, that is, come from junk, maybe 60%, 55%, 65%, somewhere in there, of those calories come from food that doesn't exist in nature and is basically non-nutritive and in some cases anti-nutritive. That is, it makes you sick instead of promoting health. Food is supposed to be nutritious, that is, promote health. But there's the majority of the calories that are produced and eaten in the United States right now do not promote health.
You're talking about something like Twinkies. Is that the sort of classic example?
Yeah, Twinkies, Cheetos, Coke, French fries, McDonald's cheeseburger, the stuff that we know, we think of, whatever comes to your mind when you think of junk, Apple Jacks.
Well, French fries can be pretty good if you make them at home. I'm sure you have probably 5 recipes for them. But
and if you eat them once a week, yeah. As a staple, you know, sometimes the dose makes the poison. A teaspoon of sugar is not going to kill. It's not going to hurt very many people. But half a cup of sugar, a cup of sugar a day is going to give you diabetes.
I just want to mention for the people, because there are people from lots of different countries going to hear this. And what you said about corn, Iowa, the amount of corn grown here is astonishing. And I drove once to play a music festival where I perform each summer in Minnesota. I drove from New Hampshire to Minnesota. There was constant corn from about a third of the way through New York State all the way until pretty much the end of the drive. Almost not an exaggeration. It was shocking. You think of corn in Iowa, you think of corn in, I guess, half of Nebraska and some other big states, but it was basically an hour and a half, 2 hours from the Vermont border, the corn started and it didn't end. It's unbelievable.
It is literally tens of millions of acres.
One obvious question that comes to mind, Mark Bittman, is without all of the chemicals and the gas-powered tractors and the John Deere's roaming around, would we have been able to grow enough food to feed a swelling population?
Well, in the way, it's the wrong question. I mean, forgive me for saying that, but we are not responsible. I don't know who we is, but when you ask that question, I think you mean, again, forgive me for interpreting you, but I think you mean, can industrial agriculture feed the world?
Could we have avoided it as a society? Could we have just, could some force have stepped in and said, we're not going this direction, we have to figure it out some other way? Was that the only solution at the time?
I don't know. And neither does anybody else. It's like saying, could we have avoided racism or could we have avoided poverty? I mean, maybe, but we weren't smart enough to be able to figure that out. Or some of us weren't, enough of us weren't smart enough to be able to figure that out. The question is really, how do we move forward? And we move forward in two ways. One, by restricting what industrial agriculture can do. And let's not go all the way to asking the question of, can we live without industrial agriculture? Let's just start with, how can we make industrial agriculture better? Can we use fewer pesticides? Can we endanger fewer workers? Can we torture fewer animals? Can we produce more nutritious food? Can we poison less water? And so on. Let's try that stuff first, while at the same time, let's try supporting people who are farming in ways that work instead of trying to subvert them and converting them to becoming industrial farmers or succumbing to industrial farming. It's not so black and white where we say, can we get rid of industrial farming in the next couple of years? There are dangers involved in the way we're farming now, and the sooner we address those dangers, the better. But it's not like we're going to fix this overnight any more than we're going to fix income inequality overnight. But we have to take measures to move in the right direction. So, yeah.
What can people are probably daunted by what you're saying. What's a simple thing for someone to do? One or two little changes that they can make. I don't know if it's meeting a farmer nearby, and all of this implies that you have the resources to spend however much the eggs at the farmer's market cost or whatever the local chicken cost instead of, you know, but yes, we're assuming that you do have that. If you don't have the resources, that's something we can talk about later. But assuming you have the financial resources and a little bit of time, and you want to make a change, what can someone do that's not radical, but that's sort of would make a difference?
People with resources can change their own diets, and people with resources can indeed shop at farmers markets or join a CSA or anything like that. But anybody can be involved in community activity, political work, whether that's local or working on more national campaigns, to try to get people in office who understand that food is a big issue and who are willing to work and push legislation to remedy some of these problems. I mean, people who live near, and this winds up being an income issue also, but people who live near consolidated animal feeding operations, CAFOs, are subjected to amounts of airborne, mostly airborne, but also waterborne poisons to the point where their health is threatened. Not that is to say that they are subject to a far greater number of carcinogens than people who don't live near factory farms. Now, that's something that has to be solved by legislation. Those people can change their diets and they can exercise, they can do whatever they want to do, but unless they can afford to move away, they are living in carcinogenic hot zones. That's the kind of thing that we need legislation to fix. So yes, some of us can change our diets, some of us can change our lifestyles, but we all, and that's just one small example. We all need legislation that's going to reduce industrial agriculture's impact on public health, on climate change, on income inequality, on poisoning the environment, and so on. And those things are legislative. So it's great to change the way you eat, and it's great to be healthier, and it's great to, even if you have time, to model new ways of farming or new ways of eating or new ways of cooking and so on. But in the long run, we need legislation that protects all of us from the damage that industrial farming is causing right now.
You've been around the country a lot. You've seen a lot of these farms. Everybody's seen some clip of a video of the way animals are treated at these huge plants. I wonder, what is it like to have to live near that? I mean, do people wake up? It's a serious question. Do they wake up thinking, I wish I could move 5 miles down the road? I'm not being glib.
They do, and it's probably more like 20 miles. But there's a terrific film. I happen to have been executive producer, one of the executive producers of it, which turns out doesn't mean that much. But there's a terrific film called Right to Harm. Came out about 2 years ago, and it's about people living in the neighborhood of factory farms and the damage that's done to them. And it's a really good film, but it's not uplifting, I have to say. It's not encouraging. It's really scary. And of course, people who live in those, anyone who can afford to not live in that situation doesn't. I think I didn't cancel out all my double negatives there. If you can afford to not live near a factory farm, you don't. So everybody who does live near a factory farm does so because they can't afford to leave. And then, you know, when their kid gets sick or their husband gets sick or their wife gets sick or whatever, they find ways to leave anyway. But it's not easy for those people because they tend to be people with not a lot of money.
I'm going to steer us in a different direction temporarily because everybody talks about music on this program a little bit, even if they have the most passive interest. But you mentioned you love the cello. What's your experience with music? You liked it as a kid, or you go to concerts now, or you did pre-COVID, or you listen to some Vivaldi on the FM? What do you do with music?
I listen, and I've always listened. When I was young, I went to concerts. I can't stand concerts anymore because I don't think they've changed. I think I probably didn't like them when I was young either, but I did a lot of things out of social pressure when I was young that I don't bother with now. I love to listen to music at home. And, you know, the cello thing is kind of interesting because at some point I got turned on to the Bach cello concerti and really liked that. And then, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, I was thinking, well, there must be other cello music besides this Bach. Why don't I see what's out there? And I came across some, I imagine they're contemporaries of yours, people, a woman named Gretchen Janover and a woman named Julia Kent.
Sure.
Who are contemporary cello composers and players. And I don't know. I like that stuff a lot. But I have my tastes are so eccentric and eclectic both that they're impossible to describe. And I also think that I'm completely not with it. So I don't know. I don't know what makes me like something and what makes me not like something. But I do know that I don't seem to be growing that much. That is, I'm not listening to a lot of contemporary stuff.
Well, I don't think that you have to listen to contemporary stuff to be growing. I mean, I think if you get to know a piece of music,
good point,
on a more deep level, no matter what it is, you're growing. I mean, I've been sort of growing with the Bach suite since I was 9 years old, and they haven't changed, but I change as I study them more and as I live with them more.
Right. Well, I'm not a student of music. I just enjoy it. But I've always enjoyed it, and I enjoy it a lot. So, yeah.
But what is it about? Why do you hate concerts now? What happened?
I think I realized that I used to make this joke, which is actually, well, if I could read while I was at a concert, I would be okay with that. But I am, I have ADD or I had ADD or whatever. I like to do two things at once. I'm actually not doing two things at once at the moment, but
I was going to ask, are you doing a crossword on your phone or something while we're talking?
Right. Not smart enough to do that. I can focus when I need to, but listening to music has always been something. I can't just listen to music. I have to be doing something else.
No, no problem. There's no requirement on this show. It's just
right.
There's one thing that people are going to be thinking about, which you address in the book here and there, which is why can't we just eat a vegan hamburger? Okay, now a lot of people wouldn't do that, but some people would do that for the sake of the betterment of the environment, etc., using less meat, but you write the current version of the fake meat solution in quotes is another example. Although vegan burgers laudably offer an alternative to meat, one that's produced without animal suffering, they're still ultra processed and they fail to address monoculture, chemicals, extraction, exploitation, nor will they replace industrially produced meat. Okay, we get the point. So how useful are vegan burgers? How useful is eating vegan? You're talking to someone who's a total omnivore.
There's nothing wrong with eating. I mean, unless you have an ethical problem with it, there's nothing wrong with eating some animal products. If you have an ethical problem with it, then you don't need to listen to me. But from an environmental perspective and from a health perspective, from a nutritional perspective, there's no problem in eating some animal products. We eat so many that we've had to produce animals in using objectionable techniques and techniques that are poisoning the environment and producing not very good animal products. So there's no question that we should be eating less meat and fewer animal products in general. The question is what replaces them. And again, I'm not talking about, oh, let's become vegan. I'm saying, okay, let's eat fewer animal products. Let's eat more real food, food that's closer to coming out of the earth. So I have no problem with a vegan hamburger, but people have been making meat substitutes forever. Tofu is a meat substitute, obviously, but you can grind up rice and oats or oats and black beans or any number of combinations of animal products and turn them into a patty and cook the patty and put it on some bread and put ketchup on it if you want to, and there you have it. The kind of vegan burgers that are being mass produced, and the so-called tech vegan burgers, which don't really rely very much on tech, but anyway, are ultra-processed foods. And they're processed to the point, again, where they're not recognizable as real food. And we don't need that. And we don't need, rice and beans is a near-perfect combination of food. Beans are the world's leading source of protein and also a near perfect food on their own. We don't need to process them beyond the point of recognition and add 15 different ingredients to them and call them an impossible burger. There's no need for that. And we're doing that in order to support venture capitalists who see this as a $1 billion business, which it is, but it's not doing anyone any good except for the $1 billion businessmen. I mean, it does reduce animal suffering theoretically, but there's no indication that consumption of meat has gone down since the introduction of the new generation of fake meat burgers.
You mentioned chickens before. You had chickens. What's the food situation like at your house? I don't know where you are, but what do you do there? Do you raise anything else other than chickens? Do you shop at a farmer's market? Talk personally.
I have a garden, but I live about 60 miles north of New York City, so it's a 4-month, 5-month garden. But I'm lucky enough to live on a farm. My partner runs a nonprofit that's on a farm, so I'm the CSA is around the corner. I do CSA pickup every week. I do shop at our town's farmers market. We actually belong to 2 or 3 CSAs because we like playing around with those. And yeah, the only animals I raise are chickens, and they are pets. I've come to adore them, and I really like taking care of them. It suits me, but I work at home, so I have some time to do that. And I have some time to garden, and that works out for me.
You have other ventures that you're doing other than writing books. You run a newsletter where sort of you farm out articles to young up and coming food writers. What's all this about?
There's a way in which I've had people work for me over the years doing research, recipe testing, recipe writing, and so on, and it seemed that there had to be a way to encourage them to stick around if I liked them. And two of the people who work for me now have worked for me, I mean, for decades. A third is my daughter, so I've known her whole life. And a couple others are newer, but people I really like and want to encourage and so on. And it seemed that there was an opportunity both for me to be more independent. I left the Times 5 or 6 years ago and haven't really had a steady gig at a media company since. I mean, that's not entirely true, but it has changed. And the way things are now, we have a Substack publication. It's called The Bittman Project. And it was an opportunity both for me to be more independent and for me to be able to nurture and support people I care about in their work. And so there's a core group of four or five of us, and we hope to grow it and provide a place where new voices can be heard and where people who have things to say have a place to say them, and where we're not bound by traditional notions of what food writing means. Many food publications focus only on cooking or only on travel or only on restaurants, and a couple, but very few, focus on policy. We run the gamut from cooking to federal food policy, and we do it all in one small little place, and that makes us unique. So we're hopeful about this. So far, the project is only a couple of months old, so it's early days, but it's been fun. It's been rewarding. Yeah, we hope that it becomes self-sustaining.
I first heard your name quite a while ago. My older brother was studying abroad for a year of college in Sydney, Australia, and suddenly he was caught with no mom to make meals and no dining hall. All there was a communal kitchen in the Unilodge right across from University of Sydney, very different from Amherst College, where he was a student. And he runs to a bookstore, pulls off the shelf How to Cook Everything, a bright yellow cover, Mark Bittman.
There you go.
And it said it saved him, and it taught him not just how to cook, but how to love to cook. And he called me. International calls were kind of tough back then in the 2004, 2005 area. And he called me and he said, "This book is incredible. It's changed my life." And it was a bright yellow cover.
Well, that's How to Cook Everything. And I hear that a lot. And needless to say, I'm really happy.
Not just that. It's not just about learning to do it, but it's learning to like to do it. And, you know, I can teach someone how to be a proficient cellist, but I can't teach them how to love to do it. That has to happen naturally, but that's what your book can do with people.
You know, I used to think it's funny because it goes full circle back to where we started talking. I used to think that everybody should cook, and it was my mission to show everybody that cooking was a pleasure. But of course, not everybody likes the same things. I think it's important that some percentage of us cook. Over the years, I've come to think what's really important is that everybody have a right to eat good food. And whether they cook it or not is secondary. I think it's up to us as food advocates, as humans even, to figure out how everybody gets to eat well, because it's critical to life.
Getting out of this situation that we're in with the huge meat processing plants and the agriculture and the tons of chemicals sprayed around the fields in Iowa. Legislation from the federal level, is this the best hope?
I don't know about federal level. I mean, I would say, honestly, it's an important component, but many things can change on a local level. School lunches can be changed on a local level. The way that a hospital or a prison or again a school or anything that's controlled by a municipality, the way that food is bought for that municipality is often controlled on a local level. So there are changes that can be made. You know, it's not just, I mean, we talked a little bit before about how people with resources can act differently and change their own lives or the lives of their family, maybe the lives of their neighbors. But similarly, we can work as neighborhoods, we can work as towns, we can work as cities, we can work as states. Ultimately, there is going to have to be legislation or regulations by the Environmental Protection Agency, by the Food and Drug Administration, by the Department of Agriculture, by the U.S. Congress, by the president, that protects us from doing food badly. We need clean water acts and clean land acts. We need better regulations on pesticides, on how animals are raised, and so on. Most of that is going to happen on the federal level, but there are lots and lots of changes that can happen locally.
I like that you write change that starts by recognizing that access to healthy food is a basic and universal human right, and that the planet's well-being takes precedence over corporate profits. It's a wonderful line. I hope we can all get to agreeing on it. It seems that we have a long road ahead of us.
You know, almost every country in the world acknowledges that food is a right. Good food, access to good food is a right that their citizens naturally have. Ours doesn't. So it could start with a question of what is food for and what is people's right when it comes to food. And answering that question will go a long way toward putting us on the road to doing things better.
Are you an optimist? Are you an optimist about this? It seems that you've laid it out on the table. You lay it out in the book. You mentioned the movie where you executive produced and you said it wasn't sunny. What are you feeling sunny about regarding all this?
Well, I think we're in a window of optimism. I think the election, the early days of the current administration and the current Congress are encouraging, but I think it is just a window. And not to, you know, jump onto a completely different topic. But if my feeling is that if Democrats pass progressive legislation around food and climate change and employment and income and so on, they will show that they're actually different from Republicans, and maybe there'll be a longer term in office and a period where more solid, good legislation is passed. I think that if the Democrats lose control of the Congress in 2022, then we will have had 18 or 24 months of an opportunity that I hope we don't miss. But I'm currently optimistic, but I haven't spent a lot of my life being optimistic, so I'm prepared to not be optimistic again.
Okay, only time will tell, Mark Bittman.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, I thank you very much. I hope you'll come back. There's a lot more to talk about.
Well, I'd love to. Thanks for having me. It's really fun.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.